Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Well, everybody knows his voice and his friendly face. My friend Jody Demling, publisher of 24/7 Sports, and of course you hear him on the radio all the time. How are you, my friend?
You know what? It's been a long 6 weeks, but I am I'm hanging in there, and it's just weird, Leland. You know, it's one of those things where I don't know what's next, but I also don't want to know what's in the future. And I can't remember some of the past, so it's kind of like, you know what? I just go with the flow now.
Well, a near-death experience will do that to you. It'll make you kind of like check things and go, what in the world is going on? Many people know of your situation where you contracted COVID-19, fought through it, were victorious. Let me start with the cheesy question. As a sportscaster, how analogous was this to winning the game? Or is that just dumb?
No, it was, I've thought of it in so many different ways. And, you know, a friend of mine said something, another sportscaster here in town said something the other day. It's like, you know what, was it a three-pointer or was it a half-court shot? And I said, you know what, no, I'm going to think of it as I did a snowbird and it was a wide open layup and all I had to do was make sure it connected, because I don't really want to think about it in the worst way possible.
Right.
But yeah, it's it's one of those things where it just feels I feel bad when I watch TV and I see all the numbers and I see other people and other stories, but then I smile because I'm like, I'm lucky for some reason. And there were a lot of people losing family members and you know, fathers and brothers and that kind of thing, and I feel lucky, you know. And then I saw a stat where in New York 80% of the people that have gone on the ventilator have passed away, and I'm like, well, geez, maybe it was a half court shot, you know, because I was on the ventilator for almost 7 days. So just a lot of different emotions.
Walk me through it. Like, how did you figure out you had it? Was it, you know, you felt a little sick and maybe you thought it was allergies? I know you're dealing like everybody else in the Ohio Valley with allergies right now. Yeah. But how did it come on?
Well, my wife is the one that, she says she knew that it was COVID before we were tested, but it was March. So I went to the ACC tournament with Louisville and was doing color analysis for the radio. So I was going to do it on WHAS. Obviously they didn't play a game. That was on March the 12th that everything got canceled. We came back on March 13th. So I was with the team, not on a, I mean, we were on a flight, but it was 54 people, 52 people, something like that. So it wasn't a packed plane. I think I was by myself in my row, both going there and coming back. So it wasn't like I was around a ton of people there. We only went to the arena one time. So came back from the ACC tournament, and my family had already been self-distancing, doing the thing, because my son has a heart condition, and my wife, we're very careful,
right,
about things like that anyway. So we went, before everything was shut down, we went to dinner one time as a family. And then I went to the grocery store two or three times, went to the radio two times before we got shut down, and made from work, to work from home. And then also I went to the post office once, and then came and went to our church. I'm the athletic director at our church, so I went to the church twice to do some things, but I wasn't around anybody. I wasn't around people. So that's the crazy part to start off, is I have no idea where I got it.
Right.
And I don't think I ever will. So those were the places I went basically in 14 days.
Right.
So it was 14 days from the time I got back from the ACC tournament till that Wednesday night, March 25th, or 13 days, March 25th, and I got real chilled that evening. We went to get some takeout, went to see my mom. She came out in the driveway. We talked to her through the, we were in the car. She was in the driveway. We talked to her for a little while. And when we came home, I told my wife, I said, I feel kind of chilled. and she took my temperature, and it was like 101, and she was like, oh man. And at that time, all it really was a chill and chills and a fever. So she said, you're staying in our room. Don't come out. The kids are going to be kind of quarantined. And she went downstairs. And so the only thing that I saw for the next week was my wife when she would come check on me.
Wow.
Or bring me something to drink or bring me and try to eat some food. I got really the fever and nauseous and stomach from Wednesday until Saturday. It got really bad on Saturday and Sunday. The fatigue did. But then early in the week, I felt like I had turned the corner. Mm. And by Wednesday, Tuesday and Wednesday, I didn't do a whole lot, but I got on my computer and I did a little work and I felt like I had turned the corner. And then Wednesday night, April 1st, is when I started coughing about 11 o'clock. And by 10 o'clock the next morning, I couldn't breathe.
Wow.
It just hit me and I couldn't breathe. I thought for a while it was because I was coughing so much. I was like, give me 20 minutes or half hour. Let me lay here.
Right.
Try not to cough. I took some cough medicine or whatever. And I still couldn't breathe. So she said, okay, we're going to call the EMS. At some point that morning, I sneezed and it felt like my bones broke. It was the most painful sneeze, one of the most painful things I've ever felt in my life.
Wow.
Now when I sneeze, I still cringe because I don't want to feel that again.
Right.
But yeah, it was for that. That's when we knew. That's when my wife knew on the week before. Like she was convinced. She was like, you've got it. But we were in contact with my doctor. She was in contact with her doctor. We have different doctors. And they were both saying, oh, you know what? They're not going to do anything for you because you don't have all of the symptoms and you don't seem, you know, it's just the fever and fatigue and that kind of thing. It wasn't the breathing and the coughing.
Right.
But when it got to be the breathing and the coughing, they were like, you need to go to the ER. We called the EMS, the fire department came, they were dressed in hazmat suits, you know, to come in the house. They had their own oxygen tanks in their own suits. And it was the weirdest thing ever. They were standing here. And I tried to get up and I couldn't get up. So
wow.
They obviously put me on oxygen, and got me out of here. And once I got to the hospital, about an hour later, my temperature was 104.5.
Wow. Holy
cow. So we were pretty lucky at the timing.
Right.
And it just from 10 or 11 o'clock Wednesday night until noon on Thursday, it's like this thing just. It just took over my body.
Wow.
It was crazy.
It's like a 24-hour period when you had thought you'd turn the corner, and then it was like an anvil just came down on you, just bam.
Yep. That's exactly right. And it's crazy too, the fact that, you know, I mean, I was not having trouble breathing. I was having stomach issues. I was having fatigue issues. I was having, you know, a fever and just didn't feel, I felt like I had the flu, but I didn't have any breathing issues. And then all of a sudden I can't breathe. And that's what, more than anything, it scares you and it freaks you out,
right,
kind of thing. And so I think I had a little panic also going on, you know, with it, but we were lucky at the timing to get me to the hospital when we did.
I think one of the things that, it's one of the most disturbing things about this virus is the fact that it's so different with different people. We can't really pin it down. Like you're talking,
right.
You know, it's like we all went and bought toilet paper. There's no real discussion of any need for toilet paper, but there is a lot of discussion of nausea. But it's like it almost seems like it just customizes itself for whoever it infects, which is frightening.
Yeah, it really does. You know, and in the hospital, I didn't get to talk or see the nurses or the doc because they were always in their mask and they were always, you know, geared up, as I like to say it. I mean, I felt like I was watching the SWAT team get ready when they would come into my room because it took them like 3 or 4 minutes to get geared up. But you know, from everything that I understand, in talking and listening to my doctors and people around me, and the other people that were in there, you know, at the time, just in the hospital that I was in at Norton Brownsboro, that it's different, and they You know, it's how do they treat things when everybody is a little different? Nobody's the same. Nobody is the same.
Right.
Nobody's the same at all. You know, for me, when I got there, they took the X-ray. I could tell from the doctor, she just the look on her face on Friday morning when she told me about, you know, going on the ventilator, I could just tell from the look on her face that my X-ray was just terrible.
Yeah.
You know, she showed me, and I don't know how to read an X-ray. It just looked all black to me and that kind of thing. You know, but I could tell that, and mine, you know, went into double, you know, I mean, it caused me to have double pneumonia, you know.
Wow.
So that's not happening to everybody. It's, you know, some people it's pneumonia, some people it's just so I mean, there's just so many different things, and you just don't know the how, the why, and the end result are all different for everybody, you know.
Right.
I mean, I have a friend that got the antibodies test and never knew he really had the virus, but he had it, you know. So so it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm seeing, you know, I mean, what I'm seeing are the vast majority of people, like, literally don't know they have it. But for some, and there's not really any way to figure out why. I mean, you know, obviously underlying conditions for the elderly is a big factor, but not necessarily. There's young people like yourself who are otherwise fine, and this happens. One of the things that you were talking about, the oxygen, like not being able to breathe all of a sudden. One of the things I'm finding that's interesting, I read an article yesterday about how people are showing up at the hospital. They don't know, like, they don't feel that sick, but they're going to get tested, or they're finding out they have it, so they show up or whatever. And they don't know they have it as, I mean, they know they have something, but it's like their breathing is fine. But they test them for oxygen levels in their blood, and it's like 50%. You know, like, which is bad. I mean,
right.
Like, they call it, there was a, I read one article where the nurses had taken to calling it the happy hypoxias, where it's like people are suffocating and they don't even know it. Like, your body is suffocating, but you're still breathing fine.
Yeah.
So I wonder if maybe leading up to where you suddenly couldn't breathe, if that was actually happening in your body, and maybe that compromised your ability to fight it at one point, and it wins the battle, and then all of a sudden you can't breathe because it takes over your lungs. That's I don't know, but
that's the thing. It's so crazy. I mean, yeah. I mean, I have so many theories, and now that I'm recovering and I feel better and I'm doing more, but I still use a little oxygen every now and then, and so I'm still kind of in the room, and I sit and lay most of the day because of my energy. So I think, you know what I mean? I think of everything, and I've been reading everything. You know, the most interesting thing that I read, in an article, is the fact that it was a 40-year-old marathon runner who had it. And I'm not in the perfect shape. I don't know that any of us in radio are in the perfect shape, but
if you find somebody, let me know.
Exactly. But I, you know, I mean, I keep up, and I had been working out, and I had lost a few pounds, and it had gotten into better shape in the last 6 to 8 months, and I feel like I was pretty healthy.
Right.
And this 40-year-old marathon runner, I mean, had it worse than I did, and was on a vent for like, I think, 16 days. And, you know, he's recovering now as well. I think he was in Chicago or somewhere like that. But anyway, the article quotes some doctors saying that they're seeing with people from, you know, from 50 under, 50, you know, from really 30 to 50 are getting, are the people that are getting the sickest are the people with really good immune systems, which is crazy. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think this thing is just, to me, it's like, it doesn't matter who you are,
it's an enigma,
or if you're healthy or if you're not, it doesn't matter. If it gets you, it's going to get you. And, and it's going to get you the tough way. I feel like the breathing thing, I'm having a little trouble now. I don't want to call it trouble because I'm doing great, but like I have a little bit of a almost a hiccup about 10, 12 times a day where it's like I skip a breath or I have a hiccup, and so I think I'm probably going, and they have it, they don't know this, but I think I'm probably going to have some long term effects.
Interesting.
You know, because of the disease or the virus, I mean, because of the virus and because of what it did and how it attacked you know, my lungs. It's still too early to tell that.
Right.
But I feel, you know, you feel things, and I kind of feel that, and I feel that's probably going to happen to me down the road, just because even with the oxygen on, like I wear it at night just in case.
Right. Sure.
I wear it all night long just in case. But I feel that little hiccup thing, and I'm like, oh man,
yeah.
Like, am I going to have that the rest of my life? And you know, they're going to do a chest X-ray on me in a couple weeks, and I've been doing virtual visits with my doctors, and we have home health and all that. So, knock on wood, I feel very good, but right. I just feel very lucky.
You know, I guess one of the things I was going to ask you too is like, what was going on a ventilator like? Were you at a point at that point where you were almost unconscious and you didn't care, or was it a traumatic experience to be on the thing, or what was that like?
Both, I'll say. So I went, it was that Friday morning. I kind of knew in my mind, I was kind of prepared just because we had heard so much, and I knew, I felt when I heard 104.5, I was like, oh, uh-oh, damn, man, this is serious. You know, right. This is really serious.
Right.
You know, and then I heard him say, what's the oxygen level he's on? And they said 100%. And I'm like, okay, this is serious. So I kind of prepared myself. Not having my wife there was difficult because, you know, there were decisions that I needed to make, and I'd have to call her, you know what I
right.
mean? And it was kind of, it just wasn't the same. So Friday morning I talked to my wife, and then the doctor came in, and the doctor said to me, it was the main hospital doctor. And she said to me that, you know, we're going to do this ventilator thing, and it's more preventative than anything. I remember even saying, tell me the truth kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, then she's like,
right.
no, she's like, we're going to prone you, which they put me on my stomach for, you know, time on the ventilator, and then flip me back over on my back and rotate it. She said, we're going to prone you. We're seeing very good results with that. Hydrochloroquine,
hydrochloroquine. Drug, yeah.
She said, we're going to do that. And she said, I feel really confident, you know, this is going to work. And then she told me, okay, but here are the things that could happen, you know, and she told me about the trach and all that kind of stuff. Well, when I got finished with her, she said, call your wife. I'll be back in a few minutes and we'll talk about it. I said, okay. So I called my wife and I told my wife, and I'm like, but I don't want to remember anything. And she's like, well, tell them, you know, it's up to you. And so I told the doctor, I don't want to remember anything. And she's like, you sure? And I said, no, I don't want to remember a thing. So after that moment of telling her that, I didn't get any drugs for an hour or two, but like my mind, like I kind of lost it at that point where I don't remember a whole lot. My wife said I talked to her again before, and I know that my wife and kids had sent me a couple of cards and letters, knowing that, you know, they wanted to get kind of a word to me before I did that. I remember reading the letters and the cards. I don't remember talking to my wife.
Wow.
I don't remember talking to my kids. I don't remember anything else really that day until about an hour and a half later. And the anesthesiologist, both of the two guys came in and said, we're putting your bed way up, and you're going to feel a little cold, and then you're probably not going to remember anything else.
So was that a medically induced coma?
No, it was not.
Okay.
It was just a lot of drugs.
Okay. All right.
All
intents and purposes, you're knocked out.
I'm knocked out. My feet. I remember my feet going up, my head going back, and the next thing I remember, this is a Friday morning at about 11 o'clock, and the next 10 o'clock, and the next thing I remember, it's Wednesday night.
Wow.
The following Wednesday night, about 9 o'clock. And the only reason I remember that it was about 9 o'clock is I heard the nurse turn the TV on and say, here's a little something in the background. And it was really bad weather outside. There was like a severe thunderstorm warning. It was lightning and thunder and everything else. And I remember that.
Wow.
So from Friday until then, I don't remember anything. Now I'll go back, to when I told them I didn't want, you know, all the drugs that they put me on. Well, so because I wasn't in a medically induced coma, but because I was just you know, kind of, for lack of a better way to say, drugged up and not wanting to remember anything.
Right.
A couple things that I've now found out while I was on the ventilator is that my wife and kids, the nurse would put the phone up to my ear every night, and my wife and kids would talk to me.
Oh, wow.
My wife would talk to me for, you know, 2-3 minutes, and then my kids would talk to me. My priest at Holy Trinity did the anointing of the sick on that Friday night. He was, my wife and kids were on Facebook FaceTime with him. He was on FaceTime with my phone and the nurse at the hospital, and he did it that way. So wow. I don't remember any of that, but it all happened, you know.
Right.
So
right.
You know, and several people that we know, a really good friend of Angela's that she used to work with is now a nurse, and you know, she came in and FaceTimed Angela from is so just different things. But I didn't know any of that. I didn't know it was going on.
Yeah.
The other crazy thing is they did the proning position, which is really, if you read up a lot about this kind of thing and how this the people that are surviving on the ventilator and doing well are the ones that have been prone.
Huh.
It beat me up a little bit. And what I mean by that is I've got a really big cut on my face.
Right.
My shoulders messed up and my knees messed up and my toes messed up. Those are all superficial and they're
right.
Fine. But when they first tried to put me in, my wife told me this about a week or two ago, I guess, I didn't even realize this, is when they first put me on my stomach, they started me out on my stomach for 16 hours.
Huh.
When they put me on the ventilator, and then they flipped me over. And she said, the doctor said, I was awake. I don't remember it
right.
at all.
Right.
But I was awake and helping them. And she said they had trouble putting me on my stomach because my chest hurt so bad.
Huh.
So, I mean, it's just crazy to think that I was moving my body, helping them get me on my stomach, but I don't remember any
wow.
of it, you know? So,
yeah.
So that was crazy. But I didn't want to, and I'm kind of I'm a little bit of a claustrophobic. I kind of get anxious and
right.
in spaces and all that kind of, and I don't like that, you know? So I knew in my mind that if I remembered any of that, or I was awake for all that it just wouldn't be good, you know, just
yeah.
for me, it wouldn't be
and
good.
Maybe the now, trauma would actually make your immune system even weaker.
Exactly. No,
yeah.
exactly. I think I would have tried to fight like being on the ventilator more than anything. And,
right.
and I just think it wouldn't have, it probably wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have been good. Now back to that Wednesday night, they started to wean me off of the medicine. They were going to take me off on Thursday is what the plan was, because the x-ray on Wednesday was really good, the chest x-ray. So they're going to take me off on Thursday morning. So on Wednesday night, they had to wean me off of the medicine. So like I said, it was about 9 o'clock. TV was on, lightning and thunder outside. And I wake up and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm just laying there. My hands are strapped down.
Right.
My feet are not, but my hands are strapped down, and I've got that, you know, that ventilator, and I can feel it, you know, like in the my tongue, the back of that ventilator. You know, it's just so weird to think, and so weird to have. And I freaked out a little bit. Probably an hour after I kind of got back to normal, I started hallucinating a little bit, and that's the medicine. I mean,
right.
they say that happens to everybody. And I started seeing some things in these animals and this kind, it was just weird. and I kind of freaked out. And the nurse came in and, you know, they were like, there's nothing in here. We know.
Were you like, I swear to God, there's a koala hanging from the ceiling tile.
It was weird. It was this animal that kept coming at me from with different faces. And I
oh,
was just
weird.
Like, what is going on here? And, you know, but it was just the medicine.
Yeah.
And so I kind of freaked out. And then I said, and then, you know, not to get too spiritual and that kind of thing, but, because I get emotional when I talk about this, but
sure.
this is when I kind of knew, knock on wood, that nothing, you know, else happens, but I kind of knew that I was okay. I kind of knew that, okay, this is gonna be okay.
Right.
About, it was probably about between 11 and midnight that night. So I'm going to get the vent out in the next morning. And I've just been freaking out for like 3 hours, or just kind of restless and just not in a good place. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Seeing yeah. things and all that. And I had been crying, and I had something in my eye, and I couldn't get it out. And I got my hand strapped, so I just couldn't get it out. You know, it was something in my eye. And the nurse comes in, and she thinks I'm still seeing things, and I'm trying to say no, and I'm kind of kicking or whatever. And I bat my eyes, and finally the nurse says, "Do you have something in your eye?" And I just kind of looked at her like real big, like, "Yes, please wipe my eye. Get it out of my eye. You know? And I can't talk, and I can't move, and I can't do all that. And she wiped both of my eyes out, and it just felt so, like, I was just a relief.
Yeah.
And she was right there, and she had, you know, she kind of patted my hand, and I just grabbed her hand, and I grabbed her hand and just squeezed it.
Yeah.
You know, and not having your family there to be able to be in the room with you, I hadn't had any of that since I woke up. You know what
right.
I mean? So I squeezed her hand, and she squeezed my hand back. And she kind of just smiled and looked at me. And for some reason, I just felt this like calm, this like, okay, I'm going to be okay. And after that, I just laid there, and I was like, get me to the morning. And I went back to sleep, and I was calm. Well, since then, and finding out, I've kind of put it to a correlation that I had no idea at the time that thousands of people were sending Facebook, Twitter messages. I mean, I had 700 messages on my phone when I woke up.
Awesome.
You know, my wife was doing this whole Facebook thing of keeping everybody apprised, and everybody was praying and this yep. and that. And, you know, our priest had anointed me. My family was talking to me every night. And it's just, for some reason, that moment when that nurse, I grabbed her hand and she grabbed my hand, squeezed it back. I just felt like, you know, like I said, I know now I had so many people behind me, but I just felt like, you know what, this is, I'm going to be okay. Obviously I'm awake. This thing is still in my throat, and I must be okay. You know, they didn't really say anything, because it was a nurse that was in there, not a doctor kind of thing or whatever.
Right.
So I didn't really know, but I was like, okay, I guess I got through this. I guess I'm going to be okay. And, you know, since then, knock on wood, I've gotten a little bit better every day.
That's awesome. And it's, by the way, it's totally fine to be spiritual on this podcast. Was it, and along that line, was there a note when you, was there a point at which when you decided you wanted to not remember anything, did it occur to you that that might be the last thing you remember?
Yeah. I kind of blocked that out a little bit.
Yeah.
I kind of blocked that out of my mind a little bit, because I knew how I was, and I knew how I was going to get agitated and mm-hmm. going to get antsy and going to get that kind of thing. And I kind of thought to myself, you have to do this. Like
right.
you can't get through it if you don't.
Right.
But yet I did kind of in the back of my mind think, what if I don't, you know, what if the last thing I ever remember is my feet? And then I didn't know that was going to happen, but my feet going in the air.
Yeah.
In a hospital room. You know what I mean? And,
right.
and that's the bad thing of thinking about it now, is that I don't remember talking to my wife the second, you know, the last time.
Yeah.
You know, that morning. So thank God that it wasn't the last thing. But I do remember getting their notes. And I remember, you know, my daughter's sweet little note. And even my 21-year-old son wrote a little note.
It's awesome.
You know, so it was, I do remember that. So that would have been the last note. Thank goodness that it's not the last thing that I remember.
Yeah, but you came through, and that's where I wanted to kind of take it to the spiritual side of it. Obviously, you're a person of faith. We share a faith. You obviously have an incredible pastor or priest that was, you know, right there with you through all of this. How much of that do you attribute to God's hand on you through this?
Oh, a lot. And that's...
Yeah.
That's where it gets crazy, because my pastor's awesome, Father Bill Bowling. He's amazing and great. My uncle lives in my aunt and uncle live in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. My mom's sister, and my uncle's a deacon. And they're really awesome too. And they were, you know, talking to Angela, my wife, and you know, sending all this kind of stuff each and every night. So I had, you know, my pastor and a deacon, and then our former pastor, Holy Trinity, who I am really, really close with, probably close with him as a spiritual person more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Is now the Bishop of Nashville, Mark Spaulding.
Yeah.
And he was every day checking in every day, you know, talking to Angela about, you know, this and that and the other. So, I mean, I felt like I felt like once I didn't know it, like I said, but I felt like when I got out, I had the holy corner.
Right.
Corner, it was crazy to think of, you know, I couldn't get much holier than what I was having at the time. So yeah. That was all pretty cool. But yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of it, I've said this and I'll say it, I don't know what yet, but obviously, you know, I'm still here for a reason.
Yeah.
And at some point, I'll guess I'll figure that out, or, you know, something will pop up and it'll be like, oh, that's why he wanted me here. That's why, you know, it wasn't my time, you know, to go. And, you know, being that close, being that close to knowing that, you know, one way or another, you know, one hour or another,
right?
And I could have not made it through,
right?
Really hits home and really hits hard to the point of, man, like he must have a plan for me. And I tell you, it's scary and it's crazy. And this is, I don't mean to make light of it, but it's also kind of fun because now I know, wow, there's something's going to happen to me, you know, in the rest of my life to really make it worth my while to like fight through this and go through all this struggles, that I'm going through.
That's an exciting outlook. I mean, it really is. Yeah. It's weird. What had nothing to do with this conversation, but I just happened to watch on YouTube yesterday. Are you familiar with the comedian Michael Jr.?
Yeah, yeah.
He has a TED Talk at the University of Nevada where he did a 20-minute bit. It was hilarious. But the whole point of the bit was, you know, everybody has a setup and everybody has a punchline. And the punchline is basically the meaning in your life. You know, it's like what you were brought here, what you were called here to do. And you know, the setup, he was talking about setbacks, and he's like, the harder your setback, you know, it's like a slingshot, you know, the farther your punchline's going to go. And, you know, I don't know why, but when you were talking about that, I was thinking about that. Like this, you know, you made it through an incredibly challenging thing that is part of a landscape that's altering our country right now. And that's your setup now, and so imagine what your punchline is going to be, which is pretty awesome. You know, I mean, it's an exciting thing to think about.
And that's the other thing is, you know, you look at the numbers and you look at the people, and I mean, I think every night when I look at the state of Kentucky or even the city of Louisville, and I think, man, I'm one of, you know what I mean? Like I never really want to be a statistic, but it's like I'm one of those. Like, it's crazy to think that, you know, with what's going on in our country that, you know, I mean, here we are in our house in the East End in Louisville. And, you know, little did we know, you know, 7 weeks ago when we were watching all of this and it started going crazy, that we were going to be right in the middle of it, that we were going to be, you know, telling a story of my survival and that kind of thing. It's just crazy. It's really sometimes I have to just turn everything off and just sit here for a little while, because it really, with the way I am right now and not a lot of energy and kind of getting, you know, I mean, I'm getting emotional obviously because of what I've been through and all that.
Right.
I sometimes just have to turn it off and just chill, because it's a little overwhelming.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, I honestly, you know, as a colleague and as a friend, I am so glad that you are here with us today to tell your story, because I think that there's probably a lot of people listening that are gleaning really inspirational notes from the way that you're speaking about this, and I just think that's awesome. Before I let you go, though, I would be remiss if we don't talk a little bit about the NCAA and their notice of allegations against Louisville. So you know I got to go there.
It's crazy because everybody was talking about it this week. That was my first day really of trying to do a little work, by the way. I was trying to ease back in on a Monday in a quarantine when there's nothing going on, and then all of a sudden that happens.
But yeah.
It's nothing we didn't expect. Like, I expected this to happen in February, and I don't know why they didn't do it in February.
Right.
In that kind of thing. It's going to be interesting because Louisville has hired a guy, Mike Glazer, to help them, who is a lot more aggressive than the guy, Chuck Smert, that they hired before.
Right.
I know Louisville fans don't like to even mention that guy's name or whatever. This guy's very aggressive. His firm is the one that helped North Carolina get off of all of its troubles,
right,
or get out of all of its troubles. They're going to be aggressive. They're going to fight it to the very end. I can't imagine that they'll go with this new IARP, which is basically a complex case unit. It was formed because of Condoleezza Rice and the whole commission and that kind of thing. If you go that route, you don't have an appeal.
Right.
So I don't think Louisville is going to do that because I think they want to fight this to the bitter end. And I see both sides of it. Look, I mean, they are a repeat offender. Mm-hmm. They did get in trouble, and they did, they're accused of a level one and three level threes while they were on probation. I mean, I see that.
Right.
The first thing is, I mean, a lot of people out there talking about the death penalty, they're not going to get the death penalty.
No.
And that's simply a couple of reasons. The NCAA doesn't want to do that. I don't think now they just don't. And the other thing is they've gotten rid of everybody that was involved. I mean, Malik Williams is going to be a senior next year. He's the only person left in the entire program that has anything to do with the old regime. And he never played a game for Rick Pitino. He was just
here
in that class.
Right.
He was just in that class that was arriving, and he decided to stay. So he never played a game, for them. I think it'll be interesting to see how the NCAA looks at all of this.
Yeah.
How much of the federal investigation, how much of the trial they will use, the facts that they found in the trial they will use, because the fact of the matter is, and not that this should mean a ton, but the guy that paid Brian Bowen's dad testified in federal court that there are only four people knew, and they were, one was the middleman, one was the money man, and two were the Adidas guys.
Right.
So does that play a factor into it at all? I don't know. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see how the NCAA reacts with this, because Louisville did clean house.
Right.
And there's nobody around. On the other hand, they are in that, they're not going to get the death penalty. I think the one thing that they could get, if you look at the penalties of, the past, it's like 2 to 4 years of postseason ban. They already had one. I don't think they'll get more than one. If they get one and get some other thing, some scholarships or recruiting visits and that kind of thing. But again, they're going to fight it, and then they're going to appeal, and they're going to fight it. And I think the way that Vince Tyree and Neely Bindaputi came across on Monday, I think a lot of Louisville fans were very excited about that. And I think a lot of people probably around the country were like, not Louisville fans, were like, why didn't you do that the first time?
Right.
Why didn't you be aggressive the first time? And I'll never understand that in all my days of why they took that self-imposed penalty and why they weren't more aggressive the first time.
You know, I look at it two ways. First of all, had the fact that the NCAA took 3 years for something that has already had a trial and dispatched long, long ago,
right,
is part of why I think Louisville's on firm ground to fight aggressively. And I say this, full disclosure, as a UK fan, okay? I think they're on firm ground to fight it. But secondly, if you're going to come down hard on the university, you also have to come down hard on the coach who is no longer here but is now going to be coaching somewhere else. It seems inordinately unfair to me that Louisville took all the steps that were necessary to fix the problem by firing everybody associated with it, even ones that might not have had anything to do with it, and essentially cleaning house. But if you still punish that institution, but not the coach who's now coaching at another university, yeah. I got a problem with that, you know, and I think that's yeah. part of why they have case to be so aggressive.
Yeah, I do too. And the other thing will be interesting too, because if Louisville would pick to go to this new route, the IARP, remember, Condoleezza Rice and that commission that they put together, they talked about punishing the people involved
right.
more, you know, harder than the school kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, that, I mean, could they do that and try to hope that, that I guess they could. There's just so many unknowns in it. But yeah, you're right. I think if Louisville gets a punishment, Rick Pitino, Kenny Johnson, Jordan Fair, the three coaches in this whole thing that are alleged to have been involved in it, they also have to.
You right. know, right. You know,
Jordan Fair is not coaching anymore right now, I don't believe. But Kenny Johnson's coaching another university also. So
right.
it's like, what are you going to do? You know, if you hammer a U of L, then you've got to do something, the same thing to those coaches. And again, I just don't know. I don't know. It's going to be crazy. The only thing I do know is that this time next year, you could call me back, and I'm very thankful that I can do this podcast and that I'm here to do this podcast, but you could call me back a year from now, right now. And I would imagine that we are either just wrapping it up or we don't know a final answer.
Yeah, that's a great – yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's one of the things that drives me nuts about the way the NCAA handles things. So, well, listen, hey, yep. It's really great talking to you. I'm so glad you made it through this. We're glad that we still have you. We prayed for you all the way through. And, you know, I mean, you're a guy who's an inspiration now to the state, to the city. You had if there's a lot of people of faith in Louisville, you had a lot of people. If you could have a whole city praying for you, you did. And yeah. So we just are super appreciative that you made it through and that you're still here with us.
Yep. No, and I appreciate you. And I appreciate, I mean, that's the thing. Everybody, I can't thank people enough. And everywhere I go and everything I do, I'm like, I keep looking and going, okay, I just got to. I'm just going to put I'm just going to get a shirt that says, I thank you for praying for me, because it really, really did help, because it's just so many people. And I was just very overwhelmed, but I thank you also. And it's been fun.
Awesome. Thanks, brother. All right. Talk to you later. Wow. Jody Demling, you know what he went through, you know, and we've talked a lot about the coronavirus on this podcast, but this was an angle that we haven't had. We haven't had somebody who's been through it. And of course, Jody's a friend, and I was watching very closely, you know, all that social media that his wife was like updating everybody every day. Here's his situation. And I remember when I saw on Facebook that she was like, tomorrow he's going to get off the ventilator. I went, you know, because I'm like, that was like, I remember seeing that post. So thank goodness. And really cool and amazing faith story that he had as well. I thought that was really super. So anyway, with that being said, his story speaks for itself. I got nothing else to say except this. Thanks to my co-executive producer and co-host, Cameron Mills, sometimes co-host. I promise he'll be back. Also to Dynamics Audio in Lexington, Kentucky, for providing the music for this podcast. And thanks to you. I put up a post on Facebook last week. We are continuing to grow, reached our biggest numbers yet, thousands of downloads a week. It's just stunning to me, and I can't put into words how much I appreciate you all hanging with me and supporting me. Big plans in the works. We'll keep you posted each step of the way, but thank you for helping this podcast to get to the level that it's at, and the subscription is free. So if you haven't subscribed yet and you just stumbled across this and you think, hey, this is pretty cool stuff, please subscribe, share it with your friends. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on Spreaker, and on iHeartRadio. If you have the iHeartRadio app, just search The Disruption Zone, and it will deliver new episodes directly to your phone, so you can carry me around in your pocket. Yes. All right. Again, thanks to everybody. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it's at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I am Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.